And welcome to Radio Free Nintendo, episode 308. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me as always are James Jones.
I am here.
That's interesting. Guillaume Veillette.
I'm interesting.
And our returning guest, Nate Andrews.
Guys, this is a disturbing trend.
Wow. No, you don't come close to a real thing.
All right. Welcome back to the show, everyone. Thanks for listening, as always. We have a sort of a special episode this week, maybe not in a good way, but it's going to be shorter than normal because Guillaume is very, very busy this weekend and will not be able to edit. And so
throw me under the bus, will you?
Are you kidding? He drives the bus.
I'll run over anybody I want to. No, man, it's cool. We all got to take a week off sometimes. So anyway, yes, this week will be a little bit shorter episode because James and I are going to somehow split up the editing duties, I think. And so we're going to do a shorter episode so that we survive that process. It's going to be all new business. We'll probably still take a break in the middle, so you'll have two fairly short segments, but they'll both be new business. And I will kick it off, I think, because I've got a brand new WiiWare game to talk about.
Wait,
probably going to end up being one of the last WiiWare games that will be worth discussing on this podcast.
Or ever come out.
Yeah. No, I'm sure things will continue to come out. They'll just be...
Well, you make it sound like there's a deluge of things coming out now. There really isn't. I mean...
Well, no. But every now and then you see some, you know, piece of shit thing that pops out there and... anyway, La Mulana is not a piece of shit. This game, I want to say this was originally announced for WiiWare around the time that WiiWare launched in 2008.
I don't know if it was that long ago, but it was...
I feel like it's been a long, long time.
I feel like
coming.
It was like 2009.
Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe so. Even then, that's 3 years
for
a WiiWare game.
When I heard it was coming out, my first thought was, wait, what? Isn't it already out?
Well, this game has taken so long to come out that its original publisher just finally gave up and said, forget it, we're not the publisher anymore. And so the developers basically published it themselves, as far as I can tell. But La Mulana originally came out on PC a few years ago, kind of like Cave Story. And, you know, I think like Cave Story, it is very much a retro style game. It has really, really cool, 16-bit graphics and music. And, it's basically a platformer, but with some exploration stuff. I mean, it has a lot in common with Cave Story. And the action, there is jumping around for sure. There is, fighting enemies, but it's more slow paced and more, I guess, it's more thoughtful the way you have to approach it because the enemies are pretty strong and, they're generally not that hard to avoid, but if you're going to go up and kill one, you need to think about how you're going to do it. And, you know, I think you can look at this game because you are playing this kind of Indiana Jones type little character and he's running around these ruins and, he's solving puzzles and he's looking for treasures. And there's actually the very first mechanic that you learn in the game is how to place a weight on a pedestal in order to use it as a switch and open up treasure chests and things like that. So it's very Indiana Jones. And I think on the surface, this looks a lot like Spelunky, which is that another PC game that was recently converted to consoles. That one's for Xbox Live Arcade. And Spelunky has a lot of fans. And I mean, I certainly think they have a lot in common in terms of challenge, but... From what I can tell, from the very little I played of Spelunky, that is more of a straight action game, and it's more set up as a roguelike in that, you know, it's full of permadeath and you can never really save.
It's procedurally generated.
It is right, exactly. So the caves that you enter are different every single time. La Mulana is more of a Super Metroid style game where the ruins are designed a certain way. They're not randomly generated or anything. They're designed and you can explore them more or less freely. and you can warp around, and there are save points, and you're meant to kind of cautiously explore this place and solve puzzles as you come to them and figure out how does this place work? Because the ruins are put together in a weird way. Some of the screens wrap around to other screens, even though it's not obvious at first that that's the case. And there are all kinds of traps, and different enemies do different things. In some rooms, you have to be really careful about where you use your whip, because if you hit the environment and not an enemy, then you will be zapped by lightning. And there's just all this really crazy stuff. It's very hard. Very hard. Not just the action, but the puzzles are really, really tough.
What are the consequences like for death? Do you have a number of lives that you start with?
The consequences for death are you go back to the last save point.
Okay.
Dying.
So there are static save points?
There are static save points, right. You can go back to them anytime you want. And they don't refill your health. So you have to find a way to refill your health. There are a couple of hot springs in the game that you can do that with. And then there's also a weird kind of experience system. Whereas you kill enemies, they sometimes drop these green orbs. And when you pick those up, it fills up a little bar. And when it fills all the way up, you don't level up, but it refills your health. So the way you increase your stats is basically just to find special items that increase your max HP. And it's not like you die in one hit. I think the character actually can absorb a fair number of hits. And I think the game is fair in that way. Where it can be pretty unfair is if you kind of go the wrong way. If you get a little out of your depth when you're exploring the ruins and you get into an area where you're not really equipped to handle it yet, it may not give you a way out of there. Now, this is what happened to me. The first time I started the game up, I played it for about an hour and got so deep into the ruins that I couldn't get back out again. And I had saved somewhere, so, you know, it's not like I was worried about that, but when I died and went back to the save point, I was already stuck.
Right, it's frustrating.
So I was like, shit, what am I supposed to do? How do you play this game? You know, like, I've clearly gotten into a bad situation, and I didn't mean to, and I don't know how to get out of it. Well, I ended up, you know, I'm a real pansy gamer. Like, I just immediately went to the internet and said, help me. And I found some excellent YouTube videos that kind of show you how to play the very beginning of the game. And I really think if you're going to play La Mulana, unless you are willing to spend several hours figuring out some very basic stuff about how the game works, I think it's really valuable to spend 5 minutes watching these videos on YouTube, because they just explain the very fundamental things about what's a good way to play the game. And they get, at least watch it to get you as far as getting the Holy Grail, which is the first major item in the game, and it lets you warp. And if I'd had this, I would have had no problem. Once you have it, you can always warp back to the village at the beginning. You can always warp back to the save points that you find at different places in the ruins. So that really opens it up and makes it feel like, okay, now I can sort of explore freely. I can try things, and the penalty is not that great. You know, I can find really cool things, and then even if I get into an area that's way over my head, I can always just warp out and keep everything that I got.
It basically Xenoblades the penalty system at that point.
Yes, yeah. So it's a weird thing, because the game is, when you first start it, it's so punishing because you don't know what's going on. And you haven't unlocked the ability to kind of just freely explore and do so with this kind of safety net. You have to play to a certain point in order to get the safety net. And then after that, it's not so bad. I mean, it's still a hard game, but you have so much less to lose, and you can take bigger risks once you have that warp ability. So that's where I am right now. I basically, where I was, I think I was literally stuck. So I just started a new save file. And it wasn't a big deal, because I really wasn't that far in the game. I mean, I hadn't really gotten anything significant yet. And that's the problem. I didn't know that you should probably buy the map software for your computer before you go in the ruins, because otherwise you find maps but you can't display them, so they do you no good, and now you're really, really, really lost.
That is a really vital piece of information the game should offer to you immediately.
Yes, it is. Yeah. You also have to buy the ability to read signs.
Yeah.
And the signs tell you very important things, really basic things that you need to know. And these things aren't expensive. You can buy them very early in the game if you know that you should. But the game doesn't even recommend that you should. It just says, here you go.
Uh-huh. So,
it's a game where it's weird because you start out and there's a character who gives you the computer and he sends you these emails and it feels like, wow, he's really feeding me a lot of information here, you know, but he's not telling you the stuff that's really important that you really, really need to know. And so that's why I would say, I mean, you can figure this stuff out by trial and error if you're willing to waste a lot of time. But you're probably better off just watching a 5-minute YouTube video, and then the game really opens up, and then you can explore it on your own.
So the item, the cup, the Holy Grail, is it the cup of a carpenter?
You know, it's not all that ornate the way it's drawn on the screen, but that's the thing about this game. It is done in a 16-bit style, and I think, you know, if you put in your head, this is really a Super Nintendo game, it looks great. It looks like a really good Super Nintendo game.
I've heard the MSX thrown around, like the style would be.
I'm sure that's true, but I have no reference point for MSX.
Yeah, there's a benchmark our listeners know all about.
Yeah, yeah. MSX is just so obscure and so Japanese that I don't know what MSX games look like. So it doesn't do me any good. But I think it looks like a really good Super Nintendo game. And the music is really cool. The controls are very nice. The jumping is a little odd in that you when you jump straight up, you can't control yourself in air until you start to come down. So if you jump straight up, you always just go straight up. But then on the way down, you can steer yourself like Mario. Whereas if you take a running jump, you have a lot more control over how far you go and changing directions. And then if you fall off a ledge, you will fall straight down. Whereas if you jump off a ledge, you can control yourself all you want to. And, you know, the game has some interesting kind of platform action, but it also has really interesting puzzles, these environmental puzzles where you're pushing on blocks or you're destroying certain things in the environment with your whip. You're moving items around and you're killing certain enemies or not killing certain enemies or whatever. And the game does provide clues as to what all of this means and how to get through things, but they are clues. They don't just come out and tell you. And because of that, it's like every room is a puzzle unto itself, that the game sort of sets itself up that way. And the ruins seem to be quite large. There are 8 major sections, and each one is like maybe 20 screens. And some of the screens are pretty complicated. They have a lot of enemies and platforms, different switches and things. So it seems like a really big game, and I think for $10, it seems like a really fantastic value. I mean, there's a lot to explore here if you've got the patience and the persistence to get through it, because it is very challenging. I've only seen the early puzzles, but they do have a kind of feeling of like a Fez. So if you're into that, if you're into this like really cryptic shit where the game the puzzles are intended to be very difficult to solve. And they maybe require trial and error, or maybe there's no way you'll ever randomly come across a solution and you really just have to sit there and think about it. And maybe eventually you just kind of run screaming to the internet for help. I'm okay with doing that because I can still, even if I go and get help and don't really, you know, I can't really take credit for solving the puzzle on my own, I can still derive enjoyment out of just respecting what the designers did and like marveling in how crazy the whole thing is. And I still am, you know, especially in this case, I mean, Fez, the actual action in Fez is not really much of a platformer. It's not very difficult. It's not challenging. Eventually, you just learn to fly, and you can just skip everything and just go straight to the puzzles. This game feels much more like an action game. It really demands certain reflexes and platforming skills, even if you just got the solution off the internet. So I think it's a really interesting animal. It's a very complex, very in-depth WiiWare game to be coming out this late in the platform after virtually everyone has abandoned interest in WiiWare games. And, you know, I think if this sounds intriguing to you, that's very much worth your time to check it out. So yeah, I'm glad La Mulana finally came out. It's still really hard to say. Also this week, I played some Fractured Soul. Because I downloaded it after Nate talked about it last week. And, you know, I think I agree with everything you said, Nate. Everything you wrote in your review.
But?
Everything you said last week, I agree with.
But?
You know, it's...
Don't rush it.
I'm sorry.
No, I mean, the artwork is pretty bad.
Yeah.
The presentation is very minimal. The level designs are interesting and challenging. The game is best when it doesn't ask you to shoot things.
Yep.
When you're just jumping and flipping dimensions. And, you know, I got a strong feel of Mighty Switch Force from it.
Yeah, I agree. Like, it's a fair comparison. I mean, it's the same kind of, you gotta click, you know, like, trigger the change in level, like, all the time while you're platforming, while you're in the air.
Right. Well, I'm not thrilled about the comparison.
Good.
I mean, like Mighty Switch Force, that's also a game where it's much better when you're not being asked to shoot something. And when you are, you keep thinking, why am I shooting in this game that's not really about shooting? It doesn't feel good. It doesn't really match the pacing of the jumping around and the flipping back and forth.
No, it totally disrupts everything. That's good.
Yeah, and it's not like there are platforming levels and shooting levels. They're always mixed together. And the shooting just doesn't feel good. You know, it's really slow. Your character doesn't really feel responsive.
Yeah, you don't have, like, a lot of range to do anything.
Right. So I feel like the game, like, there are really interesting platforming ideas in here, and the platforming itself is pretty well tuned. It's pretty tight. But because they keep mixing in the shooting stuff, that does not feel good. And also I feel like there aren't enough checkpoints, because sometimes it'll ask you to do like a solid, you know, minute or minute and a half of really difficult series of platforming things. And if you die right before the end of that section, you have to go all the way to the back. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't seem like a long period of time, but in a 2D platformer, it is. And the game is pretty difficult from what I've seen. I mean, I feel like it's pretty challenging. It asks you to do some pretty complicated things. And when it's asking you to do, you know, like perfectly execute on, let's say, 15 or 20 moves in a row without messing up, that is really frustrating, you know. And most other modern 2D platformers have gotten away from this kind of design. It's very old school in that sense, I guess. But, you know, I'm glad there aren't limited lives. You can just try it as many times as you want. But when it's a 90-second thing and I've gone through it 15 times, infinite lives is small consolation. I just want that section to be over with. I just want to move on.
So, yeah, I mean, when I played, I ran into a couple of sections like that. I feel on the whole, though, that those aren't as frequent as maybe you feel. It didn't really bother me that much.
Well, I feel that way because I'm stuck on one right now.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, if you're still stuck on one, then...
Overall, I really do agree with everything you said, Nate, but I will say about the price. I mean, I paid for this myself, paid my $12, and I think the guys who made this should be on their knees thanking Nintendo for pushing them to release it at $12, because at $15, this is a not recommended for me. And at 30 as a retail game, get the fuck out of here. Yeah. No way. The design is interesting, and the gameplay, you know, when it works, it really works, and it feels pretty good. But it's not that original of an idea, and the presentation is abysmal. It looks like shit, really. The music is not good. The controls aren't as good as they should be for what kind of game it is. And there is no presentation. You turn on the game and you just start playing. There's no story. There's no cutscenes. There's no modes. It is just, you turn it on and that's fine. I mean, I play a lot of indie games that are really straightforward like that. They don't have all these bells and whistles, but these indie games don't cost $30 and most of them don't cost $15.
Yeah, I think that stuff would be pretty inconsequential otherwise, but the price, you know, you kind of expect something more than what you get for what you pay for.
Yeah. So, you know, I think in terms of a pure platformer, it's fine, you know, but I feel the kind of the same way I do about Mighty Switch Force, except that game actually has a really nice presentation. It's still very bare bones, but at least the artwork is nice, you know, and you can see a value in that. And so, you know, if you paid a couple bucks more than you would for a game that didn't look as pretty, you could say, well, that's okay because it has a lot more charm because the character art is interesting and the game just has a nice vibrant look to it overall that makes it more pleasant to play. And you cannot say that about Fractured Soul. The game is just butt ugly. And I think you can't release an expensive game that's butt ugly.
Well, you can, obviously, I think.
Well, I think it is correctly priced. Let me put it that way. I think for $12, if you're interested in this kind of platformer, that's a good price. But they should be really thankful that cooler heads prevailed and kept them from trying to sell this for more than it is, because I don't think this would be selling at all at a higher price.
No, probably not.
Finally, my third game this week. Sorry, I have a lot to talk about, but we're not in a huge rush because we don't have any other segment coming.
No,
out.
Just take your time. I'm actually going to take a nap right here, so just let me know when you're done.
Yeah, so I'm just wallowing in my new business this week, but I've been playing a lot of games, and this is a game I started and finished on the same day last weekend. It's called To the Moon, and I have to thank an RFN listener named Sundalos, who has written in many times over the years and is a participant on the forums and has been in Retroactive and everything. Sundalos gifted me this game over Steam, and that is a very generous thing to do, and I thank you very kindly, sir, and I must ask people to not do this, please, because my Steam library is atrocious, and if you saw it, you would not even consider ever buying me a game on Steam. So thank you very, very much. I really appreciate it, but I don't want this to become a trend. Just because I wishlist something on Steam doesn't mean I want someone to buy it for me. It's just a reminder for myself later on.
He's just trying to get in your head. He wants you to buy the games. Don't listen.
No, this is not reverse psychology. I
He's
promise you.
He's fucking with you.
But To the Moon, thankfully, is very short. You can play through the entire game in about 3 hours. And I have to say, it is a lovely experience. It is just a wonderful little game. It's done in the style of my absolute favorite Super Nintendo games, which are Final Fantasy III and Chrono Trigger. And it really, the guys who did this are such good pixel artists. They really made this brand new PC game look exactly like those classic Super Nintendo games that you remember. I mean, down to the way the characters are modeled and the way the backgrounds have these kind of gradients to show lighting and darkness, shadows. It's really, really fantastic. The game just looks, I mean, it's like you feel immediately nostalgic when you play it because it reminds you so much of these games that for me are, you know, so beloved, so memorable. And the music, I have to say, one of my favorite game soundtracks ever. The music is just absolutely glorious. A lot of it's done in piano, and I think the piano MIDI that they're using is probably a little better than you would ever get on Super Nintendo, but it doesn't sound out of place. It doesn't sound so much higher fidelity that it makes the graphics look weird, you know, when combined with the music. And some of the music is a little more synthy. Some of it is just very moody, but there's a lot of great melodies and compositions. I mean, it's just fantastic music, and it's very emotional music, and it matches the game, because the whole game is really very narrative. Even though it looks like one of these classic Super Nintendo RPGs, it's really not an RPG. It's more like an adventure game without the inventory. So you're really just running, you're walking around looking at things and talking to people. That's the entire game. And it might get old after a while, but it's only 3 hours, so it works. And it's a very efficient way to tell this sprawling story that they're trying to tell. And the whole plot is, it gets really complicated, but the premise is basically that you're playing as these two scientists, or not scientists, but they're like operatives or whatever. It's very similar to the story of Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. So these two agents, they go to the house of this man who's dying, and he's like maybe hours away from death. And their job is to put on these helmets and go into his memories and grant him his final wish. And his final wish is to go to the moon. And this is just a regular guy. You know, he lived a life. He had relationships. He had a wife. He had people who came and went. And these people had problems, and he had friendships, you know, and it's not beyond the initial premise, beyond the idea of these people going into his mind. It's really not sci-fi at all. It's very personal. It's very emotional. And it's about figuring out, who is this man? How did he get to this point in his life? And why does he want to go to the moon? And the way you do that is you start at his most recent memories as an old man, and you progressively get deeper and deeper and earlier into his life. And as you do so, you uncover more about who he is and who are these people around him. And you know, what led to this chain of events. And telling the story backwards in this way is a really effective device for sort of slowly revealing these things to you. And I found that just within 15 minutes of starting the game, I cared very deeply about this character and the other characters who were introduced through the course of the game. The writing is very, very good. The music just accentuates everything. And it's just, I can't imagine someone playing this and not becoming passionate about the story and about what's happening and really, really care about the outcome. And the whole thing is just has this kind of, this sadness to it, this melancholy, but also this sweetness, you know. I mean, it is ultimately a romance story. It's about this man and his wife and how they met and, you know, what happened to them and how did they end up. And, it's really beautifully done. And, I can't recommend it enough. So thank you very much, Sundalos, for gifting this to me. And, I hope other people will go out and check out To the Moon. So that's all for me. I'm finally done. Guillaume, please go next.
I'm afraid that my new business is not really that new. It's more like a retread business. I don't know. I did play Renegade Ups after hearing Johnny talk about it for 3 minutes on the last podcast. Because after all, you know, why not? I already own the game. It's free. And
oh, you had it through PlayStation Plus?
I did. So, and, you know, like since it was short, I thought, well, why not? So I started playing it. I think Sunday night, last Sunday, and I basically played through the first 8 levels, and there are 9 levels in the game, so I kind of binged. and it is a good game, like it's definitely well made, so it kind of reminds me of Gatling Gears, this other twin-stick shooter published by EA. Like maybe it's just because they probably share the same graphical engine, I don't know, but the same look and the same kinds of weapons in a way. Also the same types of enemies. And one thing that bothered me in Gatling Gears that bothers me in this game is that you shoot, humans, but they are tiny compared to your vehicle. And your main weapon is this machine gun. And that just fires a very, very narrow stream of fire. So it's less of a problem, I think, in Renegade Ops than it was in Gatling Gears, but you have to be very, very precise and aim like this, you know, tiny needle at these tiny little humans that seem to come out of some real-time strategy game. You know, like I felt like I was playing Command & Conquer or Red Alert.
This is a weird complaint, Guillaume, because you can just sweep. I mean, it's a twin-stick shooter, so you can just sweep the right joystick across them. It's not like you have to aim at them. You can just kind of throw it in that direction and then wave the machine gun around a little bit and you'll sweep them out.
That's one thing that Renegade Ops does well. I mean, you can upgrade the machine gun and then your stream of fire becomes wider and then that strategy works. But when it's not upgraded, I you can't really just sweep like it, because it will miss a lot of enemies, I found.
You can also run them over, which is more fun.
Yeah, that game is all about being sloppy, just like fishtailing into things and exploding.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, I like being able, you know, those machine gun towers that are always at the gate of the enemy bases.
Mm-hmm.
I love going up to those and just running straight through them, because you'll kill them, you'll insta-kill them, and it's so much faster than trying to shoot them.
Do you not lose points doing that?
I don't think so.
Because I don't think, like, it shows you the points that you score while you kill enemies. Like, you see the numbers pop out, and you don't see them when you run over stuff. So I was trying to play, you know, non-stoppily, but maybe I was playing it the wrong way. I don't know. But yeah, so I binged, you know, like, I played through the game very quickly, and you were absolutely right when you said that the enemies become repetitive. And that's one thing I'm not sure I understand why I became kind of addicted to the game that way, even though after a while I kind of started, you know, it started getting tedious a little bit. I think it's because of the leveling up elements. You know, like you always, like throughout the game, you gain experience points, you gain levels that unlock new abilities. And I find myself to be like a sucker for that kind of thing.
You like the RPG sauce?
Well, I'm not sure I do actually.
The RPG sauce is spicy.
It goes with everything.
I'm not sure I do. Like, I kind of feel the addiction, and I don't enjoy it. You know, like, I'm not sure if I know how to express it.
Let go. Just let go. Bathe in the sauce.
Yeah, it's kind of the same deal with iPhone games or Facebook games. Like, they give you the rewards, you know, at certain intervals, and the intervals get longer and longer. And that's why I don't play those games. I don't enjoy myself, but I keep playing them anyway.
You're an addict.
I suppose so.
We can get help.
But then, you know, I finished the game, and I even played, you know, I tried starting a new character earlier today, and I just played one mission, and that was enough. So I you know, like, I would recommend, even though the game is short, take it in small doses, and you won't get sick of it so quickly.
That worked for me. I mean, I definitely wouldn't recommend playing through the entire game in one sitting, but I wouldn't recommend that for just about anything, so.
Right, right. So that was a fun time. And a kind of on the opposite end of the spectrum, like a game that's way more in my, you know, within my tastes is, I talked about it last week, Prince of Persia Forgotten Sands. And I find that I cannot binge on it. Like, after a while, I have to take a break. And I think that has to do with the camera issues that I briefly mentioned last week. And I didn't really explain what they were, but it's quite simply, like, they didn't test it enough. You have to keep the C button pressed and then move the cursor to the edges of the screen to move the camera around. But there are some times when, like, you keep the C button pressed and it will stop working. Most of the time when you're in movement, it seems like when you go certain places, you'll, get the camera to snap back into place, and then the camera will just stop obeying you, you know? So that's a little bit annoying. That means that you can't really move the camera around while you're moving around. You have to stop what you're doing and then look around. So that kills the flow of the game a little bit.
The whole Wii Remote and Nunchuck setup is not very conducive to controlling a character in 3D and controlling the camera simultaneously.
Maybe, but I was trying to do it, and in some games I succeed, but this game won't let me. So,
can you think of a game that does that well?
Not offhand, but...
I mean, Galaxy just totally circumvents it by just not letting you control the camera really at all. And I think that's, if you can pull that off, that's the right way to go.
I suppose. But another sign that the camera is not really up to snuff, I was at this puzzle where you have, these wheels that you have to turn, and there are these, you know, rotating handles that the prince has to push. They're both on the same pedestal. They're right next to each other, and they're right next to the puzzle. And when you hold the rotating handles, then the camera pans back and you see the whole puzzle. As soon as you let go, the camera just, you know, loses focus, and then you don't see the entire puzzle. So just the time that you take to, you know, like, leave one handle and go to the next, you can't even look at the puzzle properly. Like, it's really, like, it doesn't seem very well thought out, you know? Like, one would think that they would have that camera angle triggered when you are on this pedestal, that, like, its only purpose is to host these two handles that you are going to use to solve the puzzle, you know? So, I don't know. Like, it's just like these weird little issues that feel like the game was perhaps not properly tested.
It sounds like you want a little more camera scripting in that case.
In that case. And in other cases, I could do without it. Like, when I'm controlling it, when I'm controlling the camera, let me control it. And when I clearly have something else to do than control the camera, then please, yeah, like, do a good job controlling it.
Not many games manage to juggle doing both of those well.
Yeah.
That's what I found. Most games will either say, you know what, we don't know where you want the camera, so we're going to let you have full control of it all the time, and that way you can't complain about it. And then other games will say, you know what, we don't want you to have to worry about the camera, so we're always going to control it, and we'll try to always put it in the right spot that you need in order to do what you're supposed to do. And I find that games that try to mix those get really frustrating, because you get accustomed through you know, large chunks of the game, you get accustomed to having control of the camera. And then you get to a place where you don't have control of it anymore because you're trying to do a puzzle or something. And then all of a sudden it feels like they're taking away control from you. And it's a really weird feeling. It's not good game psychology, I think.
Nope. But that's just, I think, overall, a forgivable flaw in the game, because the game has really kept surprising me. The platforming is as good as it ever was in that series, and the locations are probably some of the most interesting ones that I've seen in the series. I mean, I have not played through the whole Prince of Persia 2008 version, the cel-shaded one. I don't know how imaginative the locations become in that game. But in this game, like, they really take the whole, like, this is fantasy. Like, this is a fantasy story. Let's put some fantasy locations here in this game. They take it much farther than the original trilogy, which was always, like, caves, catacombs, buildings, a city, you know? So I am very, very impressed by the imagination that the level designers are displaying. And I just can't overstate how people need to play this game if they have any love for this series.
Yeah, you're tempting me very strongly. Because I love Prince of Persia. I've played all of them except this specific version of Forgotten Sands.
The Wii one? Yeah, that has something to do with the other one. Beautiful.
Right.
Which is a weird trend, actually. There's other games that came out roughly the same time where the Wii version had nothing to do with the other console version.
Right. So that kind of gave people the wrong impression. Like, they're going to be, oh, obviously the HD version is going to be better because more money is going to be put into them and the graphics are going to be better and the controls are probably going to be more suited for it. But this is a made-for-Wii Prince of Persia game. Like, people complained. I know I complained when Dead Space, you know, came over to the Wii and it turned out to be a light gun shooter. On the Wii, like, it really has been the home for very made-on-the-cheap side games.
Yeah, I remember that Soul Calibur game around launch?
Ugh.
Soul Calibur Legends?
You mean Soul Calendar Awesomes? Yes, I do.
This is so not that game.
What about that Castlevania game around launch?
Mm. Oh, man.
Forgotten Sands is the made-for-Wii, meaty, good game that we've been clamoring for and that passed under our radar because it was not clear that it was, you know, the kind of effort that was put in the game. And it wasn't clear that it was a different game made for the Wii, and also it came out the same week as Galaxy.
So maybe it would have helped if they'd given it a different name.
I think so. I think so. But they wanted so much to tie it to the movie.
Yeah. Remember the movie Prince of Persia, Forgotten Sands? Oops. It sounds like a horrible branding job by Ubisoft. Imagine
wow.
That. But
shocked.
Yeah. But I, you're making me really want to track a copy of this down.
It's probably very difficult to find an expensive copy. Probably very easy to find a cheap one. So.
Oh, good. That's how I like it.
Yeah, please go and hunt for a copy somewhere.
All right, man. Awesome. Hey, so we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to hear from James and Nate about what they've been playing.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
First up this week, we have a blog called The Last Waltz, My DSI and I. By an asshole named Alex Kulaki.
Well,
my DSI and I.
I did not write that line.
After 7 years, it's time to move on. Alex is breaking up with his long-term love for a younger, more attractive replacement. Alex is going to review Black and White 2 and say goodbye to his DSI. I'd like to know where he got a DSI 7 years ago. Anyway, there's another blog called Nintendo Collector's Journal by Justin Barub. Oh no, it's a Rob, and on video. I'm reasonably certain just pointing a camera at them is liable to cause them to break, but apparently nobody told Justin. Enjoy the depths of his Nintendo obsession. Rob, by the way, is Robotic Operating Buddy if you're under 20 years old.
And they do have a tendency to stop working if you think about them.
Any time spent watching videos of Rob is time well spent.
We have a blog, TGS, Beyond the Tokyo Dome, by Ty Sugar. Oh no, someone let Ty write something. I'm sorry, Ty.
Drugs.
Ty attended TGS 2012's sweaty mass of humanity known as the Public Day. Read the only hint you'll ever get about what he told Danny Bivens, because there is no way whatever stories Ty had to tell will ever make it live.
That cannot be allowed to happen.
And we have another blog, The Rarest Street Pass Puzzle in the World, by James Charlton. Did you know that Japan has been holding out on us for the Street Pass puzzles? They have! The rarest, most elusive puzzle is the ANA puzzle, purveyors of the Pokemon plane, created to celebrate All Nippon's anniversary. Videos of Haneda Airport included, something he could not have done under U.S. security.
He could have, but he would have been arrested. It's fine.
Also, the puzzle gives you seizures. That's why we didn't get it.
Well, that's fair, actually. We also have a review of Kart Crashers, a DSiWare game by Neil Ronahan. It's not a kart racer, it's a cult action.
Cult action.
Cult action would be better. This enjoyable DSiWare game isn't about winning the race, it's about the journey to explore, defeat enemies, and collect stars. And still, it's a good download game, which is actually kind of high praise for DSiWare software right now.
Especially now.
We also have impressions of, I gave myself the Japanese text, damn it. We also have impressions of Leighton Kyoju versus Gakuten Saiban by Ty Shugart and James Charlton. Straight from the floor of TGS, we have impressions of the finger-pointing crossover the world has been waiting for. Get the impressions of the two gameplay styles, Leighton in and Gakuten in. It's like two games you love on the same cart.
James just trolled himself.
I am a master! Miss you, John. Miss you.
By the way, if you don't speak Japanese, that's Professor Leighton versus Phoenix Wright.
Yeah.
We have impressions of EX Troopers from Danny Bivens. Remember that cool-looking third-person action game for 3DS that Nintendo keeps showing off during the Japanese Nintendo Directs? You know, the beautiful cel-shaded spin-off of Lost Planet? Well, if you don't live in Japan, it looks like you're not going to get it. Which is a shame, because it's apparently pretty good. Damn it, Capcom. Damn it, Capcom!
More emphasis, come on! Damn it, Capcom!
We also have impressions
Be
of
angry.
Tank, Tank, Tank. James Charlton.
Yeah. Or Stank, Stank, Stank.
I should have come with that.
It's got three times the tank, and James is not exactly the fan. It's less than favorable comparison to Battle Tank 64, so there's that. Also, Farting Giants.
There we go.
With your face on it.
This game is a trip.
That's right. Your face is the Farting Giant.
So, we've got all that stuff this week, a lot of TGS coverage, even some we didn't have room for on here, as well as still rolling out impressions from the Wii U launch event from a couple of weeks ago, and Inside the Bubble, which is our weekly video series by Ariel Ruff that catches you up on all the latest Nintendo news in only a few minutes. Very cool thing. Check it all out over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back to the show, everybody. It's time for more new business, and James is going to go next.
Yeah, so I've got two things to talk about. After dealing with the insane and obtuse trolling that is Faster Than Light, the game, I decided that I wanted something a bit more action-y, so I availed myself of a sale that was going on at a GameStop and picked up three used games, and for whatever reason decided to play the one that I didn't actually come in there with the intention of buying, which is always a good way to start off your collection. I picked up, just because it had a decent review score and there weren't many games in stock for whatever reason that particular day, the flight action World War II game, Birds of Steel, published, weirdly, by Konami and developed by Gaijin Entertainment, who are responsible for the console versions of the ever-so-approachable Ilustrumjevic series.
What system is this for?
This is the 360 version, but I believe it's also a PS3 version.
Yep, it is.
Okay.
Yeah, so
an Ace Combat junkie, so I guess it kind of makes sense.
Yeah, I was hoping for something kind of you know, high action, you know, twitchy. Yeah, it doesn't have that.
Did it come with a flight stick?
It didn't. I wish it did, because then I wouldn't be on this podcast right now, busy going, "Come on, turn!" So this game is a more relaxed simulator than people who are familiar with the Sturmjovic series, but it can still be pretty unforgiving. It's basically various World War II campaigns floating through the air. And I'm still relatively early in the game, but if you know anything about World War II aviation history, you realize that means I'm still flying a stupid biplane, which is horrible experience, because despite having large wings, they control via cables, which means they don't control at all. So lots of the game has been spent trying to take off and land and going terribly sideways.
It's called fly-by-wire.
Yeah, literally. Actually, there's a wire that connects your wings and pulls them into shapes. Yeah, flight physics was not great in a biplane. But the game, even in its most easy mode, is pretty unforgiving in that respect. But what I found about the game that I like is when I actually get into combat, it can be visceral enough and enjoyable enough that it feels good. You know, World War II had lots of really close fights with large numbers of aircraft, so there's a certain amount of energy involved. The game looks really nice. There's particularly enjoyable missions where you're doing early combat from aircraft carriers against capital ships, which I find to be really fun. But for whatever reason, maybe it's to enhance the realism, the game feels like you should fly everywhere. So that means there's lots of flying from waypoints before you actually get to your objective. Now, you'll warp after you hit a waypoint to the next waypoint, but still, it's a lot of tedious flying. And even in the most arcadey mode, the controls are really, really, really obtuse sometimes, especially if you're in a biplane. But be that as it may, the online mode is actually really cool because you can stage campaigns, multiple battles fought across a single campaign of the war. They involve bots and users, and I haven't had a whole lot of luck getting a game going. I've had a couple go, and that's actually been pretty enjoyable. It's very much different flying against people than against the bots, in part because you can tell who's actually good at the game because they're killing everybody else, versus people who are just plowing into the ground because they still can't figure out how to control their aircraft. It's fun! I don't know, it's nice that I can get kind of halfway to the Sturmjovic, because when I tried to play those games, I found them to be horribly unapproachable and just utterly unrepentant in their evil. Whereas this game is approachable enough that I can get into the action, but it's definitely not an arcade game, even on its lowest setting. And, you know, I kind of wish it was a little bit more action-y and a little bit less authentic, even though I understand the appeal.
For some reason, I tried the demo for this game, and I don't think the demo was all that realistic. Like, maybe some toggles were turned off, or I don't know.
It may have been like the most arcadey mode, which I reluctantly refused to play for the first three times, and then I plowed into the ground and said, okay, fine.
Yeah, I probably had a lot of assistance from the game. But yeah, like I thought initially I started the demo, I thought this is enjoyable, like I could get into this, maybe. And then the missions just went on and on and on. And I found myself like going from, you know what, like I would consider getting this game to, wow, this demo is more than I'm willing to play. I've had enough. And
there's a lot of that. I mean, like, I see we're talking about how, like, you'll complete the objective of a mission and then you fly forever. Or you'll complete one objective and then you have to fly to the next one. You fly a long time. And there's just lots of downtime in the game and the missions go on a long time because of it. Is that the kind of stuff you're talking about?
Yeah, there was some of that in the demo, which is weird.
That doesn't get better. Which is terrible, because if you look at, like, I know it's a very arcadey game, but if you look at all the demos for the Ace Combat games on the service, they're like, we're going to just bombard you with intense action for 15 minutes, and then you're going to go walk out and buy the game no matter what time it is. You'll find a store. But this is like, all right, let's make sure the flaps on your wings are set right. All right, go ahead and take off now. Or like, oh, there's another plane taxiing beside me. I should let him pass. It's like, I don't want to have to worry about this. It's like, fine, I have to take off. I'm okay with taking off. But the fact that there's a plane who just cut in front of me like we're in the middle of rush hour traffic, fuck that guy. I'm ready to start shooting right now, but it won't let me. It does let you do different positions on the aircraft, though. Like, if you're in a bomber, you can do that. Or you can play as, you know, the various gunner positions on the aircraft, which is actually kind of cool. Like I said, the game looks really neat. It's a shame because there are parts of the game that are really cool. I just feel like only the most diehard fans are going to get to really enjoy them. I mean, it's got a lot of content in it, so it's a bit sad.
But you're one of those most diehard fans, right?
I'm not, though. I'm talking more like the Sturmovik people who are like, all right, I want to make sure my oil pressure is right on my aircraft before I take off.
But those people would play a game like this on PC.
That's what I was going to say. Like, they've got their flight stick, and they're not going to play this.
Their head tracking and all that.
Yeah, it is more arcadey than that. But, I mean, there's, like, so much content in this game. It's really ridiculous. I mean, there, as it mentions, there's over 100 aircraft in it, and there's a ton of battles. And there's – so, yeah, it's really cool, but there's just so much time devoted to just doing menial stuff, like flying, which might seem not like it's not menial, but if all you're doing is flying – it's pretty menial.
It's kind of like sailing in Wind Waker, except that you can't just go make a sandwich because you'll crash.
Oh, yeah, especially if you're flying a biplane, which naturally kind of lilt to one side. So you're like, I'm going to land now. Oh, God, why am I going sideways? Oh, it's weird. I'll play it some more, but it's got some weird challenges to it that I'm not sure I'm super happy about. The other game I have, I'll just mention it really quickly. When I went Steam crazy during the summer sale and I bought a couple packages. One of the games I ended up with that I didn't really care about, but it was cheaper than buying the other games individually, was called Splice, which I knew nothing about at the time. I have played it for a while and still feel like I know nothing about the game, but that's fine. We can talk about it anyway. It's a puzzle game where from what I can gather from the no instructions whatsoever the game has in it, build bacterium by essentially rearranging the different parts of the cell into a template that's laid out behind you in dotted lines, and you try to line them up. And you can only have two things from connected to any one node, or two children nodes from any one node. And you have a certain number of moves you can make before everything has to be in line. You can like replicate certain cells at certain times. So it's just a puzzle game of getting these things lined up into the frame behind them within the move limit. And it's okay, but that's it. It feels like it's a flash game.
I feel like this might have been a Layton, Professor Layton game.
It may have been a puzzle in a Professor Layton game.
Right.
It's kind of weird that this in and of itself is a whole game. So if you've got this in the Steam sale as one of your packages and haven't played it yet, it's in one of the indie bundles, don't bother. It's not that much fun. Maybe there's a flash mode out there somewhere. But it's got a neat aesthetic. But beyond that, there's really not much to it. That's all I've actually got this week. Unless anybody has any commentary on cell replication, I'm all ears.
No, it sounds a little like Space Chem, which is at least kind of looks like you're attaching these molecules together, even though they're actually meant to be different elements. But yeah, I don't. It's weird. I mean, it doesn't sound very deep. I guess it's a puzzle game, so it doesn't necessarily have to be really deep as long as it can throw different combinations and keep it interesting.
You basically only have two moves, though. And you move the piece down to a predefined position it can go to, or some pieces can replicate all their child pieces. It's like a binary tree. I mean, basically you're arranging a binary tree, which if you don't have any sort of background in that stuff, I'm sorry, I just put that into your head. Go ahead and forget it immediately. It's just not very compelling. Which is a shame, because it's the only one of the indie bundle I played that I felt like I just don't get the appeal of this game.
It's weird, because it feels like playing God should be more fun than that.
Well, you're playing like God, like when he was really like just getting started, and he's just like, God, I got to make these little. Or I guess he said, "What's it like me? I've got to make these little really basic things." Fine, stupid bacteria. You know, if we just skipped that step, we'd all be a lot healthier. But it is what it is. We also wouldn't have beer. So obviously this was a terrible decision to skip. So never mind. Good job. Good job on making those tiny basic forms of life, Divine Creator.
Yeah, good one.
I think we just heard James have an existential discussion with himself.
I had a discussion with God. Let's just be clear. It is literally an existential discussion because it is about the origin of existence. So you may continue.
I think God abandoned this podcast many episodes ago.
What, one?
Yeah, it was your laugh that drove him away.
No, I'm at episode one.
Oh.
I think his last episode was around like 292 or something.
Wow. Okay, on that weird note, Nate, could you please help us wrap up new business and indeed the episode?
I will certainly try. I've also been playing a weird kind of game called The Denpa Men.
Subtitle, oh, God. Came by wave.
Subtitle, They Came by Wave.
I like that subtitle. It's
yeah, I do
find
actually.
The pun clever.
Yeah, it's kind of like a B movie sort of subtitle. Anyway,
yeah, it sounds like Vincent Price should be saying it.
Yeah, he would not fit in with the style of this game at all.
Well, in a way, but we'll
maybe
leave
as a boss,
where,
but
we'll leave that where it sits.
But this is it's a strange sort of RPG that was released today actually on the eShop for $10. The
strange
demo came out last week. I mentioned this on Twitter to Neil this morning after he expressed some interest after playing the demo. But the game is, in my opinion, about as fun as a box of crayons.
Ooh,
the point of
crayons.
That, yeah, well, the point of that comparison is that the game is kind of cute. It's got a really bright, quirky style that's somewhere in between Pikmin and the style of a Mii, a Nintendo
yeah.
Mii.
Yep, and they're haunting.
The characters
yeah,
look like Miis, but they're not, are they?
Yeah, so, well, no, like, in battle, they will bash things with their heads, so...
Well, that's what we do, I mean, to be fair.
Yeah. So it's cute, but there's not much you can do with it, or at least, you know, not much that's interesting. The basic premise is that you start by collecting a team of these men out of the waves in an AR game. You actually have to move 3DS around and capture them in nets. But that's really the only unique hook the game has.
So it's elements, basically.
Yeah, well, and everything that follows
not after even
that.
There, not even that, because there's no puzzle to solve. It's just...
It's like the first half of elements.
Yeah, the puzzle that you will solve is very rote RPG grinding and battling. So you're moving through dungeons, fighting battles, collecting gold. Your group of men levels up.
it always does.
As do any men that you have stored back in your house.
Whoa! Speaking of God abandoning this podcast.
You mute your mic, James.
They came by wave.
All right.
We're done here.
So these men have... can have skills or defenses against certain elements, which are dictated by color and the antenna that they either do or don't have on their head. Mm-hmm. So they evolve. You can outfit them with some basic equipment. The way battles are set up, though, is super repetitive and very static. The default choice is to automatically have them fight using their skills, if they have any. So you just hit A, and it'll run through the turn of every man. And if he has a skill, he'll use it. If someone has a healing skill and another man, you know, took some damage or something, he will heal him, which is kind of nice, and it makes battles a little bit less of a chore. But, you know, you're doing that for enemies upon enemies at a time, and so that becomes really bland after a while.
Right. I played the demo last week when it came out, and I was very quickly turned off by the game. The style is cute, and I think that Jeremy Parrish in his preview said that, oh, this game has a strong Dragon Quest DNA.
Yeah, yes. I read that today, and I think, you know, that's probably accurate. But
it does, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I played the demo, and I just immediately thought this kind of looks like and definitely feels like Dragon Quest, but I feel like it's lacking the depth.
Right. Well, like, all you have really of Dragon Quest is the dungeons. And Dragon Quest would have a party of characters in some of the games that you grow attached to. But here, like, the your heroes are more disposable. Like,
if one of your men dies in a dungeon, that's it. They're gone. You have to go back either and buy offerings to resurrect them from a shrine or hope that they show up again when you go back in the AR game. Some of my men died, and the useful ones died, and I got them back, but it's still kind of a pain.
So I'm gonna drop some knowledge. This game is developed by Genius Sonority, so all your Dragon Quest connections make a hell of a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, they made Dragon Quest 6 and 7?
This is a development studio that was set up based on a lot of programmers from Dragon Quest games. I ran Pokemon games, actually. In their prior careers before the start of the company in 2002. They've already released in Japan a Denpomen sequel, so be ready for that. Yeah.
Yeah,
I've heard that the sequel has towns and has more RPG elements that...
That's good.
Yeah, that would be nice.
Yeah, because the charm of Dragon Quest is, to me, the overworld. Some of my favorite Dragon Quest games actually have more than one overworld, because I love exploring them and finding the towns and finding the secret caves and things like that. You know, getting the ship and then getting the airship or the dragon or the giant bird or whatever. But the dungeons themselves are not that much fun to go through.
No, and here the dungeons are the only thing that you have. They're just icons on a menu. Yeah. And, you know, I played for like maybe 6 hours so far, and I've gotten through 3 dungeons, and I think I've read that there's 7 or 8 more, so there's apparently a lot to go through. It's just not that exciting.
Not super
compelling. Yeah, and like I think one of the problems is that all of the guys that you can catch have only one ability and one resistance.
Right.
Right. And so they're very disposable, but also you have to switch them out to face like whatever new challenges that you're facing. Yep. And so you don't have a function to unequip everyone to equip like your for your new party to gear up, you know?
Yeah.
Like there is no easy way to
compare stats unless all your men die, then you get everything back, but
right. But I mean, like, there's no way to quickly optimize our gear, and like, looks like there's a lot of time spent, like, in menus trying to figure out who did I give this piece of equipment to, and, you know, like, who's resistant to fire, and who has, like, this ability, and, it looks like a lot of micromanagement for the type of game it is.
I will say, if you're curious about this game, but don't know, even if you want to commit to getting the demo, just go to the website. If you don't immediately get creeped out, go ahead and download the demo. Because it is haunting. As there are men dressed as the Denpa men.
Oh, wow. That's
like actual people.
Yeah. Thanks for the heads up.
That's stuff of nightmares.
Chapter art suggestion.
It's there. Just saying.
I think it might have been more fun if they just let you use your Miis. Because then it would be almost like an expanded version of Find Me. And I think that is part of the appeal of Find Me, is that you kind of know the people who are going through and battling these enemies for you.
Oh, I mean, it's a Nintendo second party that made the game. They certainly could have if they wanted to.
Oh, yeah. It's Genius Sonority, so.
Or maybe if they just showed up as Denpa whatevers. Sure. And like if they just showed up in the wave.
Oh, yeah, you can dress them up, put them in these silly costumes or whatever, but I think seeing the people's faces and having their names over it would make you feel a little more connected to the characters, because these guys are just very generic, you know?
Well, yeah. I do think, though, that if the characters are supposed to be disposable, that might make them somewhat less disposable. You'd be like, well, I don't want myself to die, but I'm terrible.
And so this is an interesting conundrum, James. Are you saying that, like, We would have problems playing Pikmin if the Pikmin had names?
If they had our name.
No, but if they had names at all, I mean, would you feel... I mean, people already feel guilty when they let Pikmin
out. You know, I think there are people who would feel much worse playing Pikmin if every Pikmin had names. However, it would also be very hard to represent them all on screen.
When did Peter Molyneux infiltrate this podcast.
No, 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 because
imagine a game.
Because we're not talking about the fact that I can breed my dog for 7 generations. Just let that sit out for a while. I mean,
what if every time you had a Pikmin that died, you saw his entire life play out before you,
and you had to go to his funeral, tell his Pikmin wife that he's not coming home
at the funeral? That's kind of bold. Hey, just come to this funeral. I'm not telling you whose it is, but you should probably come. Just saying. I'm not sure Olimar possesses the emotional depth of character to present that kind of knowledge, that kind of information. To the Pikmin wife and the Pikmin orphaned children.
Mm-hmm.
It's yikes.
This is fucked. What happened this episode?
I appreciate that Denpoman is only $10 and it's an RPG for 3DS, and that it's going to appeal to a lot of people because of that. But yeah, I feel like this is a classic case of, you know, the game obviously had very limited budget and was probably made very quickly, and so the way that they sort of pad it out and make it feel like there's a lot to it is they just sort of make it really repetitive and they put a lot of grinding in it. And I felt that from the demo.
Yeah.
So
it took forever to collect enough gold to buy a potion.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. So yeah, I immediately really felt like, you know, this is cute, but I really don't have 30 hours to waste doing this over and over with no real reward of like seeing new places or doing new things or feeling like I'm accomplishing something in the story. And that's the thing about RPGs. It's like, I guess some people do enjoy just kind of grinding through battles for their own sake. But for me, that's something I'm willing to do in the service of some larger goal. And if you don't have that larger goal, it's not a good RPG in my opinion.
You know, I think the fact that they've already produced a sequel to this game in Japan, that at least according to Danny's Nintendo Japan Downloads article from a few weeks ago, has so much more content, kind of makes me feel like this game probably was a little bit rushed.
Yeah, maybe like, the game is the demo of the second game.
This is the London life to fantasy life is what you're telling me?
Exactly.
Supposedly this was the second most popular eShop game in Japan.
I'm shocked. No, I'm not.
Oh, man. So, Nate, have you been playing anything else this week?
I've been playing a little bit of Torchlight 2 when I should be doing other things, probably. Uh-huh. It's a pretty good distraction game. I would say that I haven't played much because that's what it feels like. Steam says I probably played like 7 or 8 hours. Which still is not that much for a game like this. But I really like it in a different way than I like a game like Diablo 3, which also came out this year.
What do you mean, different way? Aren't they the exact same game?
So, they are the same kind of game, and if you like those games, you'll probably get the same thing out of it. Torchlight 2 is a lot different in its design and aesthetic. It's a lot more lighthearted. I feel it's a lot easier to get into and have fun with than Diablo, which is kind of more number and stat intensive. There's just a bunch of things that make it really accessible.
Well, the first one definitely had this kind of cartoony look to it.
Yeah, and that's back. Diablo is all like putting you into hell and, you know, like the halls of agony and making you fight through every disgusting beast imaginable. But Torchlight 2 is more of an adventure, if that makes sense. You know, you're going through these lands that are pretty expansive. They're pretty varied.
Oh, that's a big change from the first one, then.
Mm. Yeah, the first one was just a mine, if I remember.
Yeah.
Sort of that. But no, this time you're in, like, the mountains, snowy mountains or something like that, or
oh, cool.
A grassy plain. So, yeah, it's really, really pleasant to go through, even as you're killing things left and right.
You're playing it by yourself?
Yeah, I haven't played with anybody else yet.
Right, because that's the big new thing, right?
The first one is just single player.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And they promised multiplayer in the sequel. Yeah. And they did give us multiplayer. So people were waiting for Torchlight 2 for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't tried that yet, so I don't know how it measures up to something like Diablo 3, which, you know, its issues with online necessary aside, it really did some good things with jumping in and out of, you know, your friends' games and stuff like that.
So I played the first Torchlight on my netbook because it came out right about the same time that I bought my netbook, which was 3 years ago now. And it didn't run great, honestly, on my netbook, but it ran – I mean, it had like a netbook mode where it turned off everything, and yeah. It ran. The frame rate sucked, and it would lag, and it was still kind of annoying, but it worked enough that I could play it, and I beat it. I suffered through bad frame rate for like 30 hours or however long it took me to beat it. And with the sequel, even though I'm sure it still scales down to some extent, my netbook is, you know, it's now weighed down with 3 years worth of things on it, and, you know, the minimum spec is probably a little higher for the sequel than it was for the first game. And it's made me, like, this is not a game I want to play on my big gaming PC where I sit there and, you know, like, I don't want to sit there for that long and play a game like this. Like, it to me, this would be best as a portable game, but because I don't have a portable computer that's really capable of running it, I feel like I'm just going to wait. Because I am kind of interested in these Microsoft Surface tablets that run Windows 8. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that they'll really be any good or that they'll be affordable, but whenever they come out, I'm going to kind of read a lot of reviews. And if I can get one, part of the reason I would want to have it is for basically portable PC gaming, because you can hook up a controller to it and you can hook up a keyboard to it even if you want to, and USB, and they will run Steam, and they will probably run a lot of games that run on Steam. So that's kind of how I'm kind of holding out for Torchlight 2 based on that. I know it's kind of a weird reason to wait for it, but I'm curious still. I mean, I don't know that I really need to play a lot more of this kind of game. I mean, I even downloaded
It's definitely not something that you need to hurry to. Yeah. You know, it's you know, people have been anticipating it for a while just because of, you know, the first game, but it's something that you can really jump into anytime.
Yeah. I mean, the first game kind of came out of nowhere. I mean, not totally, but I mean, it was
something kind of fresh.
It was the first game of that style to come out in a long time.
Right, and people seemed surprised that it was actually good.
Right, I don't think it was made by a very small team.
Right, like it basically, first time people heard about it was usually discussions of, "Wow, this game is good." Like, what game is that? It was very much. It wasn't a highly anticipated title until it came out. So I think that kind of thing causes games to stick in people's mind a little bit better. So I think there was more anticipation.
Yeah, yeah, but I still felt like a lot of people really enjoyed Torchlight more than I did. I think it's the whole loot cycle of picking things up and then staring at menus to do comparison shopping and figure out what you want to keep and what you don't. I get tired of that really quickly. I mean, I recently started playing Borderlands 2 and really liked the first game. Second game seems fine so far, but what I like about those games is exploring the world and playing it as a shooter. Sure. And to me, the constant number crunching and you know, up arrows and down arrows, and is this piece of thing I found on the ground better than what I currently have, is way too frequent, and it's too easy to spend way too much time obsessing over that stuff. And I get to the point where I get a gun that I kind of like, and I just start ignoring the loot because I don't want to stop and look at every single fucking thing that pops out of a closet when you open it. I mean, Tycho had a really good blog post on Penny Arcade recently about this, and I completely agree with him. I think the game is fun to play, but there's too much loot. Too much, and it takes too long to go through.
I don't think too much loot is usually the issue. I think if it was much more blatantly obvious, this is better than that, I don't think the loot itself becomes an issue.
But every item has like six different stats, and so very rarely do you come across something that is strictly better or strictly worse. When you do, those are easy to either dismiss or you're like, yeah, I want to equip that. But most of the time, it's better in some ways and worse in other ways.
My point is that maybe if you're designing a game, you could streamline the amount of ways a weapon can be better or worse than another one to make this more simple.
Yeah.
Not necessarily work within the constructs of the existing stat-based architecture, but come up with some other architecture that allows things to be both better and worse in some ways, but yet make it more straightforward to make the call.
Yeah, I would love that. I wish someone would figure that out.
So, you know, that quality aside, I think, like you said, you can really just, you know, get something that you like, get a weapon or two that really works for you and still have fun with that game.
Good. Okay. Yeah, I found eventually that, you know, even in the first one, I did eventually kind of settle on the kind of stuff that I liked using, and it became easier to ignore everything else.
Right.
So, you know, it took a little while, you know.
Dump everything into your pet's inventory and sell it.
Yeah. Yeah. It is good for that. All right. Well, thanks, Nate. That is going to wrap up the episode. So, thanks everybody for listening. We're going to probably talk about Kirby the Amazing Mirror next week. So, that's our retroactive game. If you haven't been playing along, you really should start. It's a very interesting game. It's really unlike any other Kirby game. And, there's a lot to say about it. I think it's a flawed game, which is usually makes for the best retroactive discussion. So, we're going to get into that probably next week. If you haven't yet posted your thoughts in the forum thread, I'd really appreciate that. It will help us, deliver an excellent, well-rounded discussion on the podcast. You can also send your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. I'm sure we'll be getting to more listener mail soon. And I look forward to hearing what your thoughts are on the news of the day. You can also go and rate and review us in iTunes. We don't mention this every week, but it is a big help. Many of you have done it over the years, but if you're a more recent listener or if you've just never gotten around to doing this, if you have iTunes, it really only takes a minute, and we would really appreciate it. It's a big help to the show. Also, be sure to listen to the latest Famicast. It should already be in your feed if you're an RFN subscriber. If not, head over to NintendoWorldReport.com and find the article for the Famicast. I think we're talking about 3.5 hours of TGS coverage from the Famicast crew.
And
so,
apparently Ty is on it too, so.
Oh my god, I haven't heard from Ty in years. Yeah, Ty Sugard is a complete madman, and you will definitely want to hear what he had to say. So that is out. Be sure to listen to it and interact with them and let them know that you enjoy the show. And finally, I just wanted to quickly mention Jason Ricci. He provides the music that you hear every week on this fine podcast and have for the past 5 years or so. We've been using Jason's music, and I rarely give him the credit he deserves, but I just saw Jason play a local show last night, and it was absolutely mesmerizing. Unfortunately, he doesn't really tour much anymore, so it's hard to get out and see him perform live. This was a really special occasion. But you can still find all his albums. They're on iTunes, they're at record stores, they're on Amazon or whatever. And, you know, if you enjoy the music here on the podcast, I think it would be really nice for you to check him out and consider buying the album and supporting the artist if you enjoy it. So that's Jason Ricci, and as always, there are links to all of these things in the article for this episode, the show notes, as it were, over on NintendoWorldReport.com. So for this week, we're going to say goodbye and thank James and Guillaume and Nate, of course, and we'll see you all next week right here on Radio Free Nintendo.
Bye. Emergency Nintendo Direct, goodbye.
No, man, it's cool. We all got to take a week off sometimes. John takes off quite a few.
All right, I'm not sure we're allowed to make those jokes, but if we are allowed to make those jokes, let me state officially it has been my role on this show for the last 4 years to make them. So,
indeed.
While I am engaging in a ceasefire, I expect you all to not encroach upon my operational territory.
Fair enough, fair enough. It's Christmas and we're playing the music and we're not gonna go there.